Now we're recording. Today is June 25th, 2009. My name is Alicia Sell, and we are at Roanoke Public Library. I'm sorry, Melrose Public Library in Roanoke, Virginia. And I am interviewing Mr. Cecil Brown. Thank you for being with us today, Mr. Brown.
You're well.
I'm going to start with just some basic background questions about you. Some of these are kind of repeats of what I asked you for the forms. When and where were you born?
Right here in Roanoke.
And what was your, what's your birthday?
March 7th, 1948.
Okay. And how long have you lived in Roanoke?
61 years.
Okay. And just briefly, what neighborhoods have you lived in?
I was born in Northeast Roanoke, and my mother lived in Southwest and Northeast, but I stayed mostly with my grandmother. Matter of fact, she raised me, and I was in Northeast most of my life.
Okay. Do you have brothers and sisters?
Yes.
Tell me about your parents and your brothers and sisters.
You want to know the truth?
Sure.
Never knew much about my dad. I was 22 when I found him. My mother had six kids by another man. It wasn't a pleasant experience for me. You know, it was pretty rough, you know, growing up with them, you know, and my mother and his children. Well, he had six kids by her. And how extensive you want this?
As extensive as you would like it to be.
You know, it was pretty rough. They were alcoholic parents. The dad ran havoc on me, drank every day. You know, if you come to a time when you need to speak to kids about stuff like that, here's one who understand what it's like being in a family like that. And they're fighting and fussing every day. Half the time, no food, trying to go to school. I went to school anyway. Half the time, I was half sleep. I would go somewhere and get in a field and lay down and go to sleep because I never slept at home. I didn't know whether or not he was going to kill my mother, so I was up all night listening to them fuss and fight. So by the time morning rolled around, I was too tired and weak to even go to school, you know, high school. And I'd curl up in an open field somewhere or wooded spot and lay down and go to sleep.
Where were you close to your other brothers and sisters or no?
I was close to them, but my mother sent me on errands a lot, you know, to pay the bills or take the bills here and there. I was gone a lot, and, you know, they saw me, but as far as having a close relationship with them, I guess I hadn't about as close as any brother would, but by me being the oldest boy, you know, I did a lot of errands for my mother. Back then, parents didn't tell you stuff like parents do now. You knew very little about the family matters and very little secrets. Go ahead.
So you say you were the oldest boy. Did you have older siblings or were you the oldest child of the family?
I have an older sister that was, you know, that had a different father too. My mother paired us two together from babies on up. The two of us was inseparable. You didn't see one without seeing the other.
What was your older sister's name?
Florine Brown. And the other six, they're Johnsons. And she and I are Browns. And things would get so bad on the weekends, my mother would always send me and my sister down to my grandmother, Northeast, to protect us. And because we wasn't her husband, and when he got drunk, he started drinking, it wasn't a very pleasant. So she would send us every weekend. I don't care how deep the snow was, we would want to go to our grandmother's. We would walk about 7 miles. I don't care how much rain, we would go to our grandmother's. We would say, Mama, send us. We don't care. We just want out of there.
What was your mother's name, and did she work, or was she, did she stay at home with the children?
Well, she stayed at home with the children. She had to stay at home with 8 kids.
Mm-hmm.
And he had worked. You know, when he didn't drink it up before he got home, because he did mostly day work, labor. And I never knew too many regular jobs he had. He put a lot of fear in me. Mm-hmm. I still have dreams.
Do you want to share their names?
What, my sister and brother?
Well, your mother and your father. Well, and your stepfather's names.
My dad, his name was Theodore Gray. Beautiful man, humble man when I found him. I loved him. I don't understand how parents can say, or kids can say when they meet their parents that they haven't seen in years, he never done nothing with me, so. I don't see how they can say that. When I met Pop, he tried to explain. I said, you don't owe me any explanation. I'm a grown man now. They know that things don't always work out. He tried to explain how much he loved Mama and so forth and so forth. It's a long story, but I told him, you don't owe me no explanation. I love you just the way you are, just like you are. He was an alcoholic too, leukemia of the blood. And my mother, she's a beautiful lady, didn't play. You hear me? I got so many whoopings I can't tell you. I'm going to say this because I'm going to be frank. The laws and stuff they got now to protect the kids, tried it on my mother.
Mm-hmm.
Let the state come and try to tell her how to raise her kids. She'd have been in jail a lot of times because she didn't play, but she loved us to death.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew it. And she was a beautiful woman.
What was her name?
Lillian Brown. Lillian Johnson.
Lillian?
Yes, Lillian Brown Johnson. When I was 17, I had my first job when I was 15. Excuse me, 16. I was staying with my grandmother for a little while, and I had gotten off from work. Downtown, you know, caught a bus and got out from downtown. From downtown, you can walk the northeast. And I saw a man on the market that was a friend to the family. He said, Cecil, or Duke, that's what they call me. Your mother's sick. She's been asking for you all day. You better go on up there and see what she wants. She got something very important to tell you. Well, I didn't go. I went on to my grandmother. So when I got into my grandmother's, I saw my grandmother crying. I never heard her cry before. I mean, boo-hooing and crying. Then she told me Mama was dead. I said, dead? Then I got numb. I said, yes, somebody poisoned her, killed her. She laid across the bed and died in the house.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't get there. I should have went then, when he first told me. I should have went. Whatever she had to tell me died with her.
Mm-hmm.
Terrible. Very terrible.
So after that, you lived with your grandmother?
Yes, me and my sister. My sister and brothers, the other sister, were put in foster homes and separated. And but they was separated before Mama died. Things were so bad that the neighbors complained, and the state came and took my mother's kids. Put them in foster home. And me and my sister went to my grandmother. And
could your grandma just not take care of all 8 of them?
She already had 8 in the house. And I knew they locked them up, put them in jail. Mama was getting a check, a welfare check for me and my sister, because we wasn't, maybe I'm getting too personal, because we wasn't there. Because we wasn't his, and she was taking that little check for us and trying to stretch it through the whole family, which was $65 a month. They didn't have no welfare. Well, they had welfare, but you couldn't get food stamps and stuff like they do now. So it was a struggle.
Tell me about your grandma.
Oh.
What was her name? And
what a beautiful, I could have bought you some stuff on her. She was made to paper. After we left Northeast, we moved on Shenandoah right beside Coca-Cola. It was two houses on that side, the Amtrak. And my sister got all the articles in the paper about how she would feed the hobos when they got off the train. Sometimes she let them live, sleep in the hall. Beautiful lady. Cooked every day. That's why I don't like this stuff about women hollering. Well, I worked all the day. I cooked. Don't hand me that. I can't cook. I worked every day. My grandmother worked every day. Come home from work. Make a fire. She wouldn't let nobody make a fire on the kitchen stove but her. Make bread every day, biscuits, and then cook. This was every day as far as I could remember. On Sunday mornings, she would make her rolls. She would get up at 2 o'clock. She'd call me, old man, I need you to go to the store to get my yeast for my bread. I said, yes, ma'am. We'd have to cut wood and so forth. She'd get up at 2 in the morning and fix it up, sort of ride. And people would come from miles just to get one of her rolls. That was one of the most beautiful women that the God could have given a grandson.
What was her name?
Etha Brown, the short woman.
Ella?
Etha.
Ethel?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what did she do for a living? You said she worked
every
day.
She did day work. She did day work.
Is that like going into people's houses?
Yeah, she worked for Miss Murray, a lady named, well, he owned Murray Meats. He used to be right here on 24th Street and downtown in the market. She raised them, white family. She worked for him for about 30, 35 years. Beautiful lady. She died in 1986 and she was born in 1898. I used to talk to her a lot. Always when I talk to kids now, when you can reason with them, always tell them, I said, who is this lady? Oh, Mr. Brown, it's my grandmother. I said, get to know her. Beyond the title. I talk to her, ask her questions. Ask her what she was like as a child. Ask her how she was growing up, the things she do. I mean, we take our grandparents and parents for granted. They were children once. They're people. Get to know them. Mm-hmm. I used to do that with my grandmother. What was she like as a child? I'm the one, just by herself, just me and her. She'd tell me, you know, stuff like that.
How did your family end up coming to Roanoke? Was your grandma from Roanoke? Was she born here?
No, she was born in Bedford County, a place called Gould, Virginia. As far as I know, one day I'm going to go down there and investigate and check around and see if I have any kin people. Because I don't know any Browns I'm kin to in Roanoke. And then she moved to Southwest before I was born, where she raised my mother and my aunt, and she had one son. I never knew my granddad. He died when her last child was born in 1926.
So did they move here so they could have jobs? Is that probably why they moved here?
He was working on the streetcar, something like that, she was telling me, I think. So, you know, they moved here. But as far as I know.
So you never went out to Bedford or anything to visit family? Your grandma never mentioned stuff like that?
Mm-mm.
Okay.
Well, see, we didn't ask questions like that when you're small, because you don't think about it.
Mm-hmm. Describe your grandma's house for us, since Northeast is no longer, now it's where the Civic Center is, right?
Yeah.
So can you describe your house for us? For instance, was it brick? Did you have a garden out back? Did you have a front porch?
It was brick. On 10th Avenue, it was a wooden house. No lights. She had a lamp. The water, hiding, she called it the hiding, was out in the backyard, and this little faucet where to go out in an outhouse. It's the way I grew up in. And on 3rd Street, we left there. I guess I lived up there for about, 5 years. I guess about 5 years old when I left. Moved to 3rd Street, they didn't have any electric lights. They left there when I was 18 and moved on 7th Avenue. Up until the time they moved us out. But on 7th Avenue, the house was brick. had 5 or 6 rooms. And when you come in, it's she always had a table, statue of Christ Jesus, my Lord and Savior, and I love him, on the table. Sometimes my uncle, he only drank on the weekends. Beautiful man, never said 2 words to you in a weekday, but on the weekends he's ready to play, because he had a few cluckers in him. Ma'd call them cluckers. They had all kind of nip joints in the Northeast. I guess it's all right to say that, but I say this in innocence, and they were good people. He'd come in, and I remember how she used to lay in the bed scared that that statue would break, because he'd stagger up against that table, and I would see the statue rock like it's going to fall, you know, ceramic, so it would break into a bunch of pieces, but it never would fall for years. Her bedroom was in the middle of the room. You would think she was asleep, but she never slept. Beautiful woman. And sometimes I'd get up and go across the hill with my boys, 14 and 15. They say, "Duke, we ain't never heard you curse, man. You hang around us, you don't curse, you don't drink, you don't smoke, you ain't saved, you don't go to church. How you do it?" I never paid attention to it. That's why I tell the children, you don't have to compromise to be recognized. Be yourself. You don't know who you can influence. I didn't know they was looking up to me. And the best years of my life was then. Now, that's how I started getting into music. But you want me to continue on my grandmother or what?
You can, sure. Tell me how, how'd you get the nickname Duke?
I don't know. They just started calling me Duke.
And how did you get involved in music?
I've always wanted to sing, ever since I can remember. Ever since I was about 8 or 9, I remember when I was about 8 and 9, I would put a stick in the alley and pretend it was a microphone and start performing in my, you know, imagination, something kids don't use anymore, that God-given faculty called imagination, and act it out in my mind how I would act on stage. I had no musical knowledge, didn't know music, no. Back then, you had to have showmanship when you hit the stage. You just couldn't sing. If you're black, you gotta have some showmanship. But by the time I was 13 and 14, I was going up to the Star City on Henry Street.
The Star City Auditorium?
Yes.
Okay.
The Star, they had up on Henry Street. This is where all the singers came. Everybody that was somebody was there. How they tore it down, I don't know. Mm-hmm. It was an icon. There is where I met some of the most famous black singers of all time. That's where I met the great James Brown. I tell you how I met him. I used to go up on him. Jackie Wilson was my man. His vocal range was awesome, and his showmanship was awesome. And I remember meeting him twice. I would stand in front of the Star City with no back door and wait till they come. And my boys would say, "Duke, I know you ain't going up to Jackie Wilson, are you? We never had money to get." I said, "You watch me." I said, "Mr. Wilson, I need to study you tonight. I gotta find out how you do things. I've been studying you from," he would be on the Ed Sullivan Show. I said, "But now I get to meet you personal. I don't have any money to get in." He said, "You just grab my suits and put them on your back and you follow me. You don't need no money." It's amazing I didn't have cameras, camcorders then, to record and tape all this. You can, as a kid of 13 years old, meeting somebody you admired who had recorded it, I had his record, just treating you like a friend. It was awesome.
So he let you come in the Star City Auditorium and listen to him?
Yes.
And he gave you his suit so you would be kind of working for him, and that's how you got in?
Right. Well, I could have walked in with him with nobody saying anything. Mm-hmm. But he wanted to kind of honor me in a way. He wanted to not make me feel bad. So this is his way of letting me help him to feel, you know, sort of part of it. And I'm laughing at my boys, and they're shaking their head. How does he do it? Because I had a desire. I hadn't met James Brown then. We used to have games on our street in the summertime. Summertime lasts forever. It wasn't like the children today. We never was in the house. Our parents would let us. They'd run you out. Get on outside and play. So we'd use our imagination and play games. And I heard these girls talking about James Brown on the street. I said, James Brown? We were saying, we had a game. Who's the best singer? I said, Jackie Wilson. They said, no, dude. He might be the best singer, but James Brown got him in show business. I couldn't believe it. I said, no, you got to be wrong. Here I am, it's the It. I know more about music than anybody in this neighborhood. How come that I haven't heard of James Brown? Well, a guy from my oldest cousin came down from New York, and he had a live album of James Brown, Live at the Apollo, 1962, and he played it. That's the first time I heard James Brown. I heard the excitement on the album. Well, lo and behold, a month later, he was coming to Run Oak. Back then, they didn't have advertisement on TV like they do now. They put out posters in the black neighborhood of the singers that's coming. They'd tack them on trees or in the store windows or wherever. Yeah. On the poster, this had an upper torso of James Brown like this. No action shots. I told my boys, I said, man, this guy couldn't be that tough. I said, let's go up and see him. We got dressed. I'm 14 years old now. We walks up behind Hotel Run Oak. It was on this street behind Hotel Run Oak, up the street a little bit, where the light going across First Street Bridge. That's where the South City was sitting. When I got to the block where the church is over there, I said, Charles, look like somebody fighting up. Look at all them people. Somebody must have had a wreck or something. So we walked up, wasn't no wreck. It was a line coming down Wells Avenue, a line going up Wells Avenue, a line coming down Gilmer coming up, and white people didn't come across Henry Street Bridge at night because of the racism. It was a line of whites coming across Henry Street Bridge. I shook my head, I said, who is this guy that I have not heard about him, yet everybody else have. When I got up to the Star City, they had two doors before the box office, one on his side, one on that side. He had his bodyguards blocking the door, Brown, but they had the doors open because it was summertime. It was no air conditioner, just had the windows up and fans. I guess it would hold about 3,000 people. They had balconies. Mm-hmm. I looked through the doors. I like to faint it. I hadn't seen Brown hadn't come out yet. The band was playing, but I'd never seen an orchestra. I've seen bands, but I'd never seen an orchestra. He had an 18-piece orchestra. Mm-hmm. Four-piece horn section on this side, a four-piece horn section on that side, and two drummers. I said, who is this guy? Still no money to get in. We always had ways to slip in. But this particular night, they had all our ways covered. Mm. We couldn't get in. I said, Charles, I gotta find a way to get in. He said, man, you crazy, you can't get in there. In the front was a wall, about as wide as half of this table, about 5 feet high, and it had a screen, not that long, but they had the windows open inside for the screen. I said, boost me up, Charles. He said, what you gonna do? I said, never mind, boost me up. I'm gonna kick this screen in, I'm going in. He said, man, you're going to get caught. You're crazy. I said, just get me on the wall. He got me on the wall. James Brown had a lady with a table like this. The wall is behind me. She's selling pictures and albums of James Brown. But they had pop crates stacked up against the wall. I kicked the screen and she never looked around. So much commotion, band playing, a lot of people in the floor dancing, on the balconies talking. I jumped down on one set of crates. She never looked. I jumped down on the second layer. She never looked. I jumped down on the floor. Once you get in, they won't chase you because they don't want to leave them. So I mingled, went around and mingled with the crowd. And I told my boys, so long. I was in. They said, how did this guy do it? Eventually they got in too. But when the man said, "Showtime, are you ready, Mr. Dynamite?" He would come out. The man that gives you, "Please, please, please, I don't mind. I'll go crazy." Night Train. Ladies and gentlemen, the star of the show, James Brown and the Famous Flames. They had two dressing rooms, one on each side of the stage. The Flames came on one side, James Brown came on the other. When he came on like he was riding on skates on one leg. Bam, precision to the microphone. When he raised his hand, the band stopped. They better not make a mistake. A mistake, $50 fine. The next, you fired. He was very strict. All his instrument players and band members had shark skin suits and polished shoes. Your shoes wasn't shine, you was fine. The next time, fired. Brown didn't play. He doing a lot. I got a tape at home that took me 40 years to find that he did the show. Went out to California, did the same show 1 month, and when he left the Star City. You would, if you see this tape, you would see what I'm talking about. But after he came out, I went back, I shook my head. I said, they was right. Jackie Wilson cannot touch his showmanship. Then I took the moves of Jackie Wilson and the moves of James Brown and combined them. I kept practicing. I kept practicing day in and day out, night in and night out. I would practice and sing on the streets anywhere. Till I became so good in my showmanship, I would take shows up to Star City. They would beg me, "Duke, not don't take, leave, please." Singers would want to take me on the road with them to teach them showmanship between sets because I was that good. I was just as good as Brown. If you ever see this tape, I would come back. People would come from all over Virginia to challenge me. They had heard about me. It wasn't no use. I don't want to embarrass you, young man. So I never tried to show off. But they all wanted to try to, back then you had doors of dancing, and sort of like a contest, and people around watching you and judging, see who's. But there wasn't no use, miss, because none of them could touch me. I stopped Brown on stage. I was dancing one time. He was up selling Civic Center. I had got beside him, and he stopped and put his hand on his hip. But when I got into gospel back then, the churches didn't go for dancing. I didn't want to sing gospel for that reason. But God called me out, so I had to go. That is something you have to do every day, is practice your dancing every day. But the church didn't allow dancing. By me being so naive then, I'm thinking it was a sin. I had to wrestle with God for years for not dancing. I couldn't understand why he wouldn't want me to dance. That was the old saints in the church that was pumping that stuff in my head. I still can do a lot at 61, but you should have seen me at 25, 24, 20, 15, 19. I would be singing through the streets, and they would say, "Man, shut that noise up at night." I said, "You're going to hear from me." I would always tell them that, "Yeah, one day you're going to hear from me," like that. I formed my first group. This was in 1971. My first gig was a talent show at the YWCA on Orange Avenue. Bands were like gangs in Roanoke. No band like they have another band because they were rivals. There were a lot of bands here in Roanoke. We had a lot of black culture in the 60s and 70s, a tremendous lot. All in the parks in the summertime, you had bands. This particular time was a band, some friends of mine was doing a social at the YWCA. The band was down there. I asked Joe, a friend of mine, Joe Pimp, I said, "Joe, I have a group. Me and him were starting a group at the same time, but he got his before mine. I said, how about playing three songs for me and let me get some exposure?" He said, "I don't know, Duke." He said, "I'm with it." He said, "But you got to talk to the other musicians. And if they go for it, I'm for it." So we had a little powwow, and this one didn't like that one, and I had one of the Mimison Callaway. These two was from another band, the band that was playing down there that night. But me and Russ, we started the group.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, they had fired these two. Well, he was still there. Larry was still there. Larry didn't like Callaway. So Larry said, man, they ain't with it. I said, why? He said, because you got him in the group. Mm-hmm. And I don't like him. And I said, well, if you can't play for him, you can't play for us. Because one for all and all for one, Three Musketeers. So.
How old were you in this picture?
24.
And that was your first band?
Yes.
So you were 24 when you started your first band?
Yes. I was 24. And I didn't know music. I danced a song, but I'd never been with a band.
So you never read music, like sheet music or anything like that? You just learned it?
Yeah, I just learned it by ear.
Did you take music lessons ever?
No.
Or did you, were you in the band in school?
No.
Did they have band in school?
They had bands. They had music in school. But I...
You didn't want to join that?
I didn't know. You know, they didn't, they just had music. They had band over Addison. But the way I was living, I had so much shame. The way I dressed back then, you know, people making fun of me, I didn't want to get in nothing. I didn't even like school. I hated it. Simply because of the people more so than the lessons. If I could go to school like people go to school now, I'd have finished. You can get up out of bed and go to school. I couldn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
You had to have clothes and shoes. I didn't have that. And shame stayed with me for a long time. I was ashamed of everything, ashamed of myself. Shame of the way I was living, shame of my mother and dad, shame of my brothers and sisters, shame. Mm-hmm. The only way I didn't feel shame was when I was with my grandmother. It was two different worlds. But getting back to the music, he said, okay, dude, they agreed to do three songs for us. I ain't gonna bore you. Then you can move on.
You're fine.
But I had a girl in Benton, see Brown. All the shows of Star City showed me what a stage dress, how important it was. I had a girl in Benton, tailor-made all our clothes, all our costumes, suits. That band didn't know this. They thought they could use us as a flunky, a warm-up group. I did three songs, but it took me 1 month to do these three songs, to practice them. I had choreography to every song, something they didn't have. I learned that from Brown and Wilson and the show Temptation that came up to South City. When they called us to do the three songs, and we came out to one of the rooms at the Y, dressed, costume, polished, it blew their minds. When we did the three songs, word got around that there was a new group in town. But I still had no band, remember. Still trying to get the exposure. A week later, word got out that there was a band in Northwest that had just graduated. The guy that I told you, Spike, they all graduated from music in college, but they had no singers. They wanted to collaborate. So we collaborated and got together. My second gig was the Civic Center. My third gig was the Star City Auditorium, where I met all the singers.
Mm-hmm.
You talking about somebody elated. All the clubs in Run Oak. The word had got around so fast. Then I started traveling all over Virginia. After 4 years, the band decided they wanted to be a boogie band. They didn't want singers anymore. I said, well, Spike, ain't nobody gonna come out and see no band play. The women wants to see men up front. And the women gonna bring the men in. I saw him 7 years later. He said, Duke, you were so far ahead of us. I didn't even know it. You were so far ahead of time. He said, you tried to tell me. I couldn't see your vision then. He said, if we'd have stayed together, look how popular we'd have been. In the meantime, when we broke, that's when I got into gospel.
Mm.
To keep my vocals going until I got my band back together. But I never got back. I was straddling the fence. Sometimes we would sing. Our vocal harmonies was so tough. We didn't need music. We'd take a show in a minute, just walk in a club and tell the manager, "Who you got coming in here tonight?" Saying, "When I got this profession," I said, "you're wasting your money. Because anything you bring in here will blow off the stage. You had to talk like that to promote yourself. Mm-hmm. Or who do you think you is? We would take shows, gospel as well as soul. That's how tough our vocal structure was. This is the guy that got me into gospel.
What's his name?
Pete Brown. And this is my cousin. He owns a recording studio.
What's his name?
Barry Gray. His mom and my dad's sister and brother. They rehearse over there every Thursday. Matter of fact, I'm going over there tonight. This is Frankie. He sung soul. He was singing all of his life. That's me. This is Lewis Hardy. He was born in Northeast too. He's a pastor in vocalist. This is Frank English. He was the bass player. He's a pastor. Got his own church. This is Bam Bam. He plays drums. This is our dad right there. Mm. This is Sam. This is his brother. He plays bass. This is Blinken. He plays keyboard. This is John. He died last year. He played lead guitar. Mm. And this is standing in front of his mother's church.
Do you know the name of the church?
Emmanuel. I think it's Emmanuel Church.
Mm.
But I'm still affiliated with these guys. We sing all the time. I don't sing with the group anymore, but I get together. You know, like this Sunday, I'm going to sing up here at Forest Park Baptist Church. Mm. I'll probably bring Lewis, myself, Pete, and Frankie, and do some acapella singing for them.
And what was the name of this first band?
The Love Men.
The Love Men.
Mm-hmm.
And who came up with that?
Calloway. And Larry, he still sings and plays. He's a minister of his own little church. And Roscoe, he's still around. Russ, after the group broke up, he became disillusioned. He never sung again.
Mm. What was it like playing at the Star City Auditorium? Was that the happiest minute of your life?
Yes, because I saw the star. I always wanted to play it before they tore it down. And when we played it, guys was running up and down Henry Street talking about this new group that's down in Star City.
Hmm.
Man, they thought we were the Shylight. Now we wasn't the Shylight. We just a local band.
Hmm.
But I never sung. I care less about the money. I never got in it for that. I just wanted to do it. I always tell children now, get off your computer. Get off your Game Boy. God gave you hidden talents, and he wants you to discover them.
Mm.
You can't do that locked in something mechanical. Sooner or later, you ever heard of Frankenstein?
Mm-hmm.
He tried to create a monster, and the monster took him over.
Mm-hmm.
That's the same thing with these mechanical and technological toys. They take over the kids after a while. The kid can't do nothing. It controls the children.
Mm.
I said, God could tell you where your talents is, young man. But when you come downstairs on Christmas and look under the tree, you have to discover what toys your mother bought you. And you're surprised when you find out what they got you. The same way with your talents. He wants you to discover them so you can be surprised when you find them. Mm-hmm. How can you find them locked into something like that?
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, you lose your social skills when you're locked into stuff like that. When I worked in the after school programs, I would tell them, put the Game Boys up, young man. Oh, Mr. Brown, I say, put it up. We're going to do something skillful. We're going to do something creative. We're going to find out what you can do and what's in you. You may have some gift to give to the world and don't know it.
Mm.
And the mothers would come, who is this Mr. Brown? They raised such an influence on my child. And I would laugh. And they said, when I get home, all they talk about is Mr. Brown taught me. It's Mr. Brown. I love the children. It's something you have to do to love. Our parents didn't play with us. Now, when I say this, I'm not saying it from a racist point of view because it's not a racist bone in my body. Integration came too soon for Run Oak.
Mm-hmm.
It was not ready for it. The white schools could not deal with the black kids. The black kids couldn't adjust. The black parents, the black neighborhoods raised them a certain way. They didn't reason with you. White teachers like to reason. White people like to reason. I asked too, and they'll reason one time. And they tell you, look, I'm telling you, don't do this anymore. If you do it, you're going to pay the consequences. And if they promise you a woman, you got it. There ain't no such thing as, you can't reason your way out of it. That was the way we raised our children. Anybody in the neighborhood, anybody's mother could whoop you in the neighborhood if they caught you doing wrong. But then when they start integrating schools here, the black kids and the laws came out. That's why they became wild. Because there was nobody to keep them in line. Even the teachers could be strict with you and hope to God they wouldn't tell your mama. Even the teachers, they had their own way of dealing with the children, and the children understood it. But now, you know, I look at the black kids and I love them. You know, I'm just saying it. In the projects and stuff like that, they're so wild and uncontrolled and unruly, and their future is shot already. Their children can't have a future because they themselves didn't have a head start. My mother, my last whooping when I was 15 years old. One day my mother said, Happy. She called me Happy. Come here. I said, yes, ma'am. She said, you go to school today? I said, yes, ma'am. She said, okay. She said, hey, the truant officer been by here. They used to look for you there. The teachers hadn't seen you. You say you went, but they say you haven't. I said, now I'm going to ask you one more time. Did you go to school today? I said, no, ma'am. She said, go on up there and break them. That's another reason why I learned to dance so good. They didn't whip clothes. Just get them, pull them pants off. And you dancing across the floor like James Brown. And they gonna tell you, be still when I'm whipping you. How you gonna be still? I'm telling you, running from me, huh? No, ma'am. How you gonna be? They're just as tired as you when they finish. But they got the point across. And they loved us to death. And it's in the scriptures. I was just reading Proverbs the other day where it says, King Solomon says, he that spareth the rod on his child hates his child, does not love him. And then he goes on, he that loveth his child spareth not the rod. Because by doing so, you can keep his soul from hell. See? All this stuff about, it's a difference between a whooping and a beating. We got whoopings, we didn't get beaten. After we go, and mama sometimes would mean, I said, what that woman want now? Lord, have mercy. Sometimes she would say, I just call you to look at your eyes. She got a lot of whoopings from my stepdad because of me. Because he must have knew she was still in love with my dad. You know, it was. And now, when a rap and hip hop came out, that killed everything. Killed the bands. That's the biggest, and I'll tell them to the face too. That's the biggest of that's the biggest illusion of what music is supposed to be by in the black history of music. All of it is commercial. In 2 years' time, you can't remember one song they made. But I can remember all the songs of Marvin Gaye, James Brown, Jackie Wilson, Al Green, Percy Sledge.
Excuse me, does she have a lady who's interested in talking to you? How long do you think it will be?
Probably another 10 or 15 minutes, if that's okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I learned Otis Redding put me in the dressing room on a rope, as a matter of fact. I knocked on the dressing room in the alley and got me a ladder. Me and the boys. No money to get in. It didn't cost but $2.50 to see the superstar. And he was drinking a paint of red liquor. I'll never forget it. I said, come on, man. Give me your hand. We come walking on the dressing room. Everybody, now, where did they come from? I met some singers, Princess. I met some singers.
Was there an age limit for the Star City Auditorium? Or if you could buy the ticket, then you could go in?
Yeah. They had a box there like the movies do right in front.
Okay, so you weren't like, it wasn't like you were only 9 years old, so you weren't allowed to go.
Oh, no, you can hang up on the yard, you can get in, nobody care. Because see, everybody can look out after you. You see what I'm saying? It ain't like, you're not like now. See,
And you said, was the Star City Auditorium, was it mostly black entertainers, or would white,
nothing,
would the white community come to it?
It was no integration. It was just black.
Oh.
Sometimes a few whites would come up.
For like the James Brown show, but not
right.
Not typically.
Right. In 1963, they had this, they showed James Brown in the film down at the American Theater. They had just started letting blacks come into the American Theater, white theater downtown. That's where I got that. It took me 40 years to find this. The first time, they see, all of them was called the Chitlin' Circuit.
What does that mean?
That means they were doing one-nighters.
Okay.
You know, they would leave there that night and go to Martinsville, leave Martinsville. They would hit all these little counties and places, you know, in a day's time. And sometimes Brown would do two shows, two places in one day. It's called the Chitlin' Circuit. They didn't fly from here to there or lay over in a hotel in plush like they do now. They ain't nothing. Man, what... I hate to see this generation, what they call entertainment. It's sickening. You hear me? It is absolutely sickening. But anyway, what I'm trying to say is, when Brown went out there in 63, the auditorium to film this with the Rolling Stones, I got Mick Jagger the first time he came. Whites had never seen James Brown. If you see this tape, you'll know everything I'm telling you. It's on this tape that he just left the Star City. Whites had never seen Brown. When he hit that stage, they went wild. And almost some white girls, because usually when they sung in a white place where whites and blacks could go, they would have a rope where the whites would sit on this side and the blacks on this side. They would draw the line. It was terrible. Mm-hmm. And but anyway, move on. What questions you got now?
You mentioned Henry Street. I've heard a lot of people talk about Kaiser's Record Shop.
Oh, yeah.
Would you go in there sometimes?
I was in there all the time.
Did you was it Napoleon and Louise? Is that their names?
Yeah, Mr. Kaiser was always had his little white bucks on, like Pat Boone, tall man. Never raised his voice, but he wouldn't let you touch his records. Sometimes I'd go to this, you know, he would have little boxes where he put his records in, like pigeonholes on both sides of the shop. I'm going, I can't have you touching my records now. Then he's rating them like that. Let's not touch the records now. And me not having the money to buy a record. I said, Mr. Kaiser, I heard you got a new record by Otis Redding or something like that, or James Brown. Can I hear just a little bit of it? I won't tell him I ain't going to buy it. Because if you know you ain't going to buy it, he won't play it.
Mm-hmm.
But all the singers, when they came to the Star City, first they would go over to Kaiser's record shop. So I try to catch him over there and talk to him. But you had Kaiser's, you had the room down on the corner, and then you had Eric's Lounge, was another club. Eric's Lounge in the room was ran by brothers, the Cowblers. There was always businessmen in the city, beautiful family. Their father raised them that way. They never worked for anybody else. There was always a close family, business family. Then you had all your restaurants on the street and your hotels and where they stayed, and Dumas Hotel right there. Everything. Man, I'm telling you, I never thought they would. I don't see how those who went to school for political science and those who claim to be are politically inclined for what you might call black history allowed that to be towed down.
Mm-hmm.
It is the icon, the history of Roanoke, the black Roanoke. Everything there represent what black people's like when you get hit him in Henry Street.
Mm-hmm.
Down at the hot dog stand, Johnny, one of the white guys that served, the older man.
Mm-hmm. Is this at the Roanoke Wiener Stand? Is that what you're talking about? Okay. Mm-hmm.
He's going there. Charge him nothing. I remember him, young kid. Nick's. He used to work in one of the restaurants on Henry Street at Nick's. I was going out sometime with the older people. Nick's is some restaurant we didn't hang in, ran by a white man, Charlie. We hung in Charlie's because he was down to earth. Nick was sort of like a Greek. And the kids, he's, you know, they had an ABC license, so they were like kids hanging around in there. But sometimes I go in there and try to be in there, you know, cooking, frying pork chops, giving out pig feet and stuff like that, which I want to go back to. So I go down to the witness stand. My friend, remember him at Nick's? He charge him nothing. He go down, he give me 2-3 hot dogs, you know, every time I go down there.
That's nice.
Yes, it is. But it's, I could talk all day long, Princess, so he got to come in, so.
I was going to ask you just a couple of questions, a couple more questions, and then we can finish up here. Besides singing, did you get paid to sing, or did you have other jobs in addition? Did you have to work other jobs too?
Yeah, all of us had other jobs, but we got paid.
What kind of other work did you do?
I did janitorial work all my life and worked in daycare. I always worked where our children were, in daycare and after school. Raleigh Court Presbyterian Church. I never had a birthday party in my life except at Raleigh Court Presbyterian Church daycare. I was doing my work one day and one of the teachers said, "Mr. Brown, would you come to room B?" I went over there. All the kids say, "Happy birthday, Mr. Brown." I couldn't believe it. I never had a birthday party in my life, but they loved Mr. Brown. Gave me gifts.
How old were you? Do you remember?
Oh yeah, that was about 10 years ago.
Oh, that's nice.
Then just everywhere I went, I worked in the YWCA. I picked up kids every day from Fort Lewis and Salem, E.W. Carver, South Salem, East Salem, West Salem, Brampton. Ain't nothing like Mr. Brown driving the band. I worked at the daycare for First Church of Nazarene, Southeast. Worked with them and down Lancelot and Benton. Worked down there and worked with the kids in the after school program.
So you help with after school programs?
Yes.
Do you teach the kids singing?
Yeah, I wrote a song for the children. Every day I would come in and, Mr. Brown, sing this song for us. And I would sing it and in the song, it's, well, let me sing a little bit for you.
Please do.
Children everywhere, take a moment to share in this emergency. Oh, that is my introduction. Some people can be cruel. Children, don't be a fool. It's reality. Little Johnny used to play all alone every day, playing through some trees. But someone with a plan led him on by the hand. That's why Johnny's gone. B. Children, don't go out with a stranger. There could be danger lurking every step of the way. With things like candy and money, a stranger could lure you away. The children, they are still missing. Now, this is where I would get the kids to join in and help me. I would have the boys on this side and the girls on this side. And I would get them, well. I'd have the girls to say, M-I-S-S-I-N-G. That I'd have the boys to say, find a clue to set them free. And we would join in together every day with Mr. Brown singing a song. So the Lord led me to put it on the, I'm going to put it on the CD. I've been singing it for about 3 years. Then it's another part. Never walk alone when you're too far from home, walking through some trees. Someone with a plan may lead you on by the hand, so on and so on. And when I get to the girls, there's not too long ago, there's someone's daughter I know failed to be aware. Now all that's left of her is a memory in time and ribbons from her hair. Children, don't go looking for danger. There is a stranger. Just might turn your blue sky to gray. And so forth. I love the children. Always tell them, don't think y'all can fool me. Don't think you can trick me because I know kids. Right then they go to laughing. But basically that's the song. I wrote quite a few songs.
Well, that's probably a good place for us to close on. But thank you for sharing your voice with us, and thank you for sharing your story with us.
You're welcome, Princess.
All right.
You're welcome anytime.
Thank you. Okay.